This is Jacob Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio.
Hey everybody, Adam Shartoff here, FilmWax Radio, episode number 445 of the podcast. I want to wish everybody a very, very happy Thanksgiving holiday weekend. This is Friday, the 24th of November, 2017, and we went out to Long Island last night, or yesterday I should say, and we celebrated, had an incredible amount of food and wine, and it was very nice, and feel very lucky about that. It was a pretty mellow time, actually, which was welcome, you know. Sometimes family gatherings involve some drama, and, you know, people get into it. It wasn't the case this time. So I sort of have an especially great amount of energy to get right back on the track, as you know. I've been really pushing for this Kickstarter I'm doing. We're about a third of the way through, and we're over at the halfway mark by a couple of days already. I'm a little nervous. So if you like my podcast, I'm kind of doing the best, I don't know, giving the best imploration, plea. Here's the thing. If you like this podcast, as I just asked, if you do, or if you listen even somewhat regularly, or even if this is the first time you're hearing this and you enjoy what you experience, go to Kickstarter and search FilmWax, and you'll come up with the campaign. Watch the video and see all the great things. You can go to filmwaxradio.com. See all the great things that we're doing here. And by the way, when I say we, it's really just me. I mean, I've got help. I've got fantastic people who've been helping over the years, but when you come down to it, it's just me. And I'm trying to do something special, and I want to create something even, I guess, just more special. And so that's what this campaign is really about. And you can read all about what I'm trying to achieve and how I'm going to try to go about achieving it on that Kickstarter page. But every single person who is within the sound of my voice right now, if everybody of you gave me $25, and I probably would get much, 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 much closer to my goal. But I'm not asking you actually to give $25. What I'm asking you to do is just check out the page. And if you have a positive response to it, kick in anything you can. But I'm just saying, if everybody within the sound of my voice did, that's how quickly and how, you know, it would work. It does work. If I had all the people that I've ever had on my podcast and all the people who listen to it gave in just a little bit, I probably could make my goal this weekend. But things don't work that way. I get it. I understand it. And everybody has a ton of responsibilities, just as I do. And I get that. And I'm not asking you to somehow figure that I'm the first responsibility in your life. I know I'm not, nor do I deserve to be. But I am somewhere out there. And if you want to give $1, $5, whatever it is, but there's been some extremely generous people. And I read off a bunch of names a couple of weeks ago of the first group of people, and I have neglected in the last couple of episodes to do it because I was a little bit hesitant. But what I'm going to do is at the end of this podcast, I'm going to go through everybody, and I'm going to thank them. I don't have some of the names, so I can't get to probably everybody. But I've been, when I see somebody when I don't recognize the name, or there's no name on the pledge, I've been reaching out to them and trying to get that information. Well, in many cases I've gotten it, so I will get that list out at the end of this episode. So let's talk about episode 445. It is with a singular conversation with Ira Sachs. By the way, last time, I think the last episode I had Ira Deutschman. Now I have Ira Sachs. So it's just a double header of Ira's on this month. But anyway, Ira Sachs is a wonderful filmmaker. He is sort of maybe one of the quintessential filmmakers, if you will, that belong on this podcast because he's a quintessential independent filmmaker. And the films he's making are just exactly right in that, I don't know, sphere of where everybody would love to get. Yeah, they look fantastic. They're beautifully written. He's got great actors. He's got great actors. Even though he made a number of films going back now, a good, like practically 20 years now. No, it does go back 20 years because I think his first feature, The Delta, came out in 96. Since then, he made 40 Shades of Blue and Married Life. I think he stepped things up a bit with Keep the Lights On in 2012. He certainly came under, on my radar right around then with Keep the Lights. I was anticipating that, and I was able to bring him on the podcast with on that film. He came on with Keep the Lights On episode number 57. If you want to go back and listen to that conversation, which I really enjoyed. Then his next film, which I'm actually an extra in, which is called Love is Strange. I think it's also one of my favorites of his films, which co-starred Alfred Molina and John Lithgow, which, you should definitely see. You should see Keep the Lights On, too. I mean, they're both terrific. He came back on, but it was very rushed. And I felt like I really wanted to have a more nuanced conversation already with him, but it's very difficult when, they're on the cusp of releasing a film and they've got 1,000 interviews to do. So that's just the part of the headache of doing this thing. You know, you never know what you're going to get. You may get somebody who's very, very, very accessible and available to you, or you may just not get them. And with Ira, I felt like, here's somebody I felt like we could have a great conversation, and I really looked forward to it. And then he came back with last year with Little Men, which got a lot of great attention. And I don't think he came on. So he had been on, again, episodes 57, 234. Go check those episodes out. But now, finally, here we are in 445, and Ira is back on the podcast, and this is a great conversation. And we kind of chat about a lot of stuff. We didn't get into too deep into any particular film in particular, but we had a really lively conversation. You'll learn a whole lot about Ira. Also, what's been very nice and interesting, because not only is Ira, who is married to a great artist and a great guy, but he and his husband are raising twins, a boy and a girl, with FilmWax friend Kirsten Johnson, who was on not that long ago on episode number 386. There's a long conversation. She directed the documentary, or the this personal film called A Camera Person last year, which also got a lot of attention. So she's the mother, and she agreed to co-raise, like any parents, with the two guys. Now, she lives in the same building on the same floor, I think just next door or across the hall. For more about that, you can listen to the conversation with Kirsten. And then, not only that, but also independently, I've also become very friendly with Iris' sister, Lynn Sachs. And you can listen to my conversation with Lynn and her husband, Mark, both of whom are, I suppose you could say, nonfiction filmmakers. It's just the easy way to say it. Yes, kind of documentaries, but they're also doing kind of other essay films, experimental type stuff. So to call them documentary isn't really accurate. Lynn's most recent, or one of her more recent works, is called Tip of My Tongue, which I participated in. So that's still playing around. In fact, I believe on December 7th or 8th, they're going to have a screening at Union Docs. I think it's on the 7th and of December. I'll be promoting it. But it is the last night of this Kickstarter campaign, so will I get there? I'm not so sure. So I feel like there's this family that I've gotten to know quite well, and they, in a sense, all represent what is so special about FilmWax Radio, or the opportunity for me to do FilmWax Radio. It's that I can talk to all of these people in this family. Oh, and there's even a cousin, now that I think about it, of Ira's and Lynn's, named Todd Berliner, who is an academic and teaches film, or he teaches, I'm not even positive, up in, I think, Boston. I can't remember if he's at Boston College. I can't remember. But he had a book called Hollywood Aesthetic, and I had him on episode 398. So it's even more people in this family that I've gotten to know. interestingly. So anyhow, let's get into this conversation, though, because Ira is obviously working on new projects, but he is in between projects at the same time, in the sense that we weren't talking about a new brand new film. This is me and Ira just talking. Okay, so enjoy. I will be back at the end with an outro. I don't always do outros on my single conversations, but this time I will. I'm going to thank a bunch of Kickstarter backers. And if we're going to try to do this at least every, if not every episode, every couple of episodes until the campaign is over. I'm going to have another couple of episodes coming up this week, by the way, this coming week. There'll be another at least two episodes of the podcast. I have so much content that I'm trying to push out. I say it like I'm trying to cram it out there. I'm not. I mean, it's just a pleasure to do it. But it's all very, you know, some of it's very timely and time sensitive. So there'll be as much content as, meaning episodes of the podcast, as there's ever been in the coming couple of weeks. Thank you very much. Here it is, my conversation with filmmaker Ira Sachs here on FilmWax Radio.
Dear parents, by now you have all heard of my joyful news and of my sad news. To be able to finally marry Benjamin Hull, my partner of almost 40 years, in a small ceremony here in New York, was one of the happiest moments of my life. Unfortunately, later I found out that I could no longer continue to teach music at St. Grace's. Most of you and everyone at the school knew that I was gay and that Ben was my lifelong partner. I have always had nothing but support from all of you. So I would like to thank you, and also to emphasize that I understand that what happened is not the fault of St. Grace's and its leadership. Above all, I urge you to take this opportunity to have a conversation with your children about whether or not justice was served here. The last thing I want them to take from this is that they should hide who they are or what they think if they believe it will get them into trouble.
So we're in your home here, and my folks lived for many, many years. They lived just at 30 Fifth Avenue.
Oh, really? So did you grow up here? Or
no.
In this neighborhood?
No, actually, that was their empty nest dream apartment.
Oh, wow.
I grew up in Queens.
Okay.
And as soon as we were both out of the house. I have a sister, an older sister. So as soon as my parents, they had this big kind of empty house, they sold it, and they bought their dream apartment, and they moved to 35th Avenue in the 80s, and they lived there till, I don't know exactly what year, but a few years back. Uh-huh. Now. They moved. They finally sold it, and it was a good time. It probably was a good time.
And where did they move to?
Yeah, they're back in Queens, actually.
Oh, wow.
Which is not, but there's a longer version of that, why or how that happened, but they needed to, they kind of just wanted to make sure they had cash.
Uh-huh. Right.
For an extended period of time. But I'll tell you, my dad regrets. I mean, he doesn't regret it, but he misses it. He would move back in a heartbeat.
Right.
He would. He loved it here. It was just like
big change.
Yeah. 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 So, and how long have you been here?
I've been here for 19 years.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. So there was definitely a large period where, you know, of overlap where they were there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I moved here in 99.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But this wasn't your first place.
I moved to Brooklyn on the corner of Smith and DeGraw in 19...
We were neighbors there, too. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Where were you?
I had already left.
Oh, I was in 88.
No, we lived there at the exact same time. I lived on Smith and Union.
Oh.
So literally like a block away.
In what years were you there?
87 to 93.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. So
weird.
So we moved to Smith Street before Smith Street became Smith Street.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
now Smith Street is a new Smith Street, which is a very old and run down Smith Street. So, I mean, it's had a lot of... having a hard time.
Is it? It is?
Well, it can't maintain the prices of the real estate that has happened. And the people who own the buildings aren't... They want those high rents, so they're keeping those places empty. It's a kind of tragic.
Yeah.
It's a bit tragic. And Court Street, one block up, is booming because there's just a different residential population around Court Street.
They were dealing with an older economy. Court Street was a strip, the commercial strip for way before, in let's say in the contemporary era that we're living in. Because I'm sure at one time, going back even further, probably Smith was a
well, it was a Dominican street.
Yeah.
So it was a
it was like one of those ethnic neighborhoods that, you know.
Yeah. America's, so it was Dominican Street and right. primarily yeah. Italian neighborhood.
Right.
And
well, that Union Street was the divide.
Union Street was a divide, right?
It was, you know, anything
it was downtown.
South of Union Street was Italian, and everything yeah. north was Dominican up to Atlantic Avenue, where it became Middle Eastern.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And then furniture warehouses,
yeah.
right? Yeah. I missed that period, too. But, yeah, I didn't realize so it was struggling.
We're getting nostalgic.
So. We are. But it's interesting, the past. And then you moved. What year did you leave Brooklyn?
I left Brooklyn in 1999, and I moved into this apartment with my then boyfriend.
Right.
I lived here for 10 years with my ex-partner, and then my husband moved in with our two kids and their mom. We all lived here for 14 months in this apartment.
Right. How many rooms are there in here?
There's just two bedrooms. Okay. There are five of us.
So right. It was cozy.
It was cozy.
Yeah.
So I've been here almost 20 years.
Right. It makes sense, because I think Keep the lights on was semi-autobiographical, yes. biographical, as you described it, which was, I guess, referring to that, somewhat to that
it was,
relationship.
It was, you know, written from out of the experiences of that 10-year relationship, and then it was shot here mm-hmm. in this apartment. So a lot of the apartment in the film was shot in this apartment. So life continued, and rumor has it there's now a movie being made of the book by my ex. So that's what I'm hearing. So.
Wait, so
my ex partner wrote a book,
right?
About his addiction, about.
Yeah,
and then and his life, and then I made a movie, and then rumor has it now there's going to be a movie made of his book. So
I see.
It goes on much longer than we would like it to go on.
Yeah, this was about closure and putting that behind you. It just keeps
exactly.
coming back. Interesting. Well, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to invite him on the podcast.
You can. He's an interesting guy. He would have interesting things to say.
Okay, I'm sure. All right, so, I moved out of Brooklyn a little earlier, 93, and then I ended up living on 15th Street. I bought, buying my first apartment on 15th Street. So,
but between East, one of, oh,
Irving and Third, yeah. Irving and Third Avenue.
Okay.
And so, my folks are here.
Right.
And my sister had an apartment right by Astor. So on 9th Street, she lived on the building on 9th Street and like between 4th and 3rd. But right, yeah, so we were all okay. kind of created this isosceles triangle.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, for a period it was really nice. My parents were so happy.
I'm sure. I'm sad my parents are not nearby, and I feel very guilty and sad about that.
Oh.
I mean, guilty just because you raise your kids to leave you, and that seems unfair. And that's what our parents certainly did. Like, they raised us to get out of the house and
right.
to specifically to move north, I think, to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of interest in. I grew up in Memphis.
Memphis, right.
So I'll be back in Memphis this weekend, though. So.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think I met your dad.
Oh, yeah.
At the premiere, at that MoMA premiere of
uh-huh.
Lynn,
uh-huh.
Lynn's film. But he can't miss you that much. Because he's got so many other children.
Yeah, he's got a lot of kids. But you know, I think as...
And grandchildren, I have
and
to
grandchildren,
assume. Tons of those.
But I think that there's something, as people get older and older, they kind of begin to narrow what interests them. And then my parents, I would say their kids interest them most.
That's nice.
Or quite a lot.
He seemed like a really nice, sweet guy, I have to say, from appearances.
He is.
Are you his oldest son?
I'm his oldest son.
Yeah. And that's also something that is, I imagine, quite special. That,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, well, you'll have to ask him that.
Okay. Well, let's get him on the speakerphone here. No, it's interesting to hear your story. Do you feel like you're a New Yorker?
I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah.
At this point, certainly I moved here. So I come with a history, which is still a part of me, which was, you know, I wasn't raised here. So
right.
I think that's specific. I said recently I was an immigrant to New York, and my husband, who was an actual immigrant to New York, took umbrage at the use of the term, which I understand. But I've been here now for 30 years, and so I have a very intricate social, emotional, historical life here.
Yeah.
So.
But you were, I assume, brought up secularly in Memphis, even.
No, I was brought up Jewish, Reformed Jew.
Okay.
I went to Saturday school and Sunday school.
Oh, so you went to Hebrew school?
Yeah, once a week. I wasn't in full time Hebrew school, but I was in once a week, and then I was part of my Jewish youth group, and I was president of the Memphis Federation of Temple Youth. So I was involved. I was an organizational Jew.
You don't have to, make me feel stupid. I mean, how wrong I was. No, obviously very wrong. But it was like a socially motivated.
It was more social and communal than it was particularly spiritual, or certainly not spiritual. But it was an identity, and one that established some separation from the mainstream. I think growing up in Memphis, there were probably 2,000 Jewish families, so it wasn't tiny.
Yeah,
I mean, you might call it tiny, but it wasn't. It didn't feel tiny because it was cohesive, and it was a quite successful community.
It wasn't exactly Jerusalem on the river, do you know?
No.
Meaning Mississippi.
It wasn't that. But it was, it was part of my life. Yeah.
Sure. It's interesting. Also, when I was getting married, the mother of my son, Karen, she is from Tennessee as well.
Oh.
But from the central Tennessee, from that city, the music city.
Nashville. City,
exactly. So I was brought up completely, unlike you, I was brought up here in New York, but I was brought up completely secularly. My parents both rejected. In the 60s, they both rejected institutional religion. The only thing we did is we went to family seders. That was kind of it. And so when I met her, I had already gone through certain periods of exploring this idea of maybe like walking up to the door of a synagogue thinking, maybe I should go in and just sort of check it out. But I never really went through with it until I met her. And then she, even though she was a Catholic, a black Catholic Southern girl with a large family, and here I am, a white Jewish boy with a tiny family.
Right.
We still hit it off and got connected, and she thought, you should really go, we should join a synagogue. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Anyway, so I started to shop, and I ended up at this little reform one here in up the block called East End Temple.
Oh, yeah. Off University?
It is. No, that's the Village Temple.
Oh, okay.
On 9th Street, which my cousin actually was a member of. But this one was in a brownstone on, what is it called? What's the park? It's split by 2nd Avenue into two, just up on like 19th. And
Near Beth Israel?
Yeah.
The little park.
It's like parks, but
it's
split by
2nd
Avenue.
Seminary.
Yeah, exactly, right there. So kitty corner to Friends on the other side, on the north side of that park is a brownstone with East End Temple. Anyway, the reason I bring it up is it was terrific. The people there were lovely, and I did end up getting very involved. It became a big part of my life. And then when I was looking for it, though, when we decided to get married, I started to the rabbi there wouldn't do the, he was a young guy, but he said, I can't because she's Catholic and you're going to raise your children, unless you're committing for her to convert and all that.
Right.
So I started making calls. And I must have called every rabbi south of the Mason-Dixon line, trying to find a rabbi who might co-officiate. And also, it's a bigger story, and I'm not going to get into it. So at the end of the day, we found a rabbi somehow miraculously, and it all ended up working out. But it was tricky for me because I was out of my comfort zone completely,
right.
And talking to rabbis. And I was intrigued, though.
Right.
Yeah. But it's funny how, in Memphis, though, you could definitely have more.
Well, I think, there was both, people participated, they belonged, but there was also a lot of internal shame and anti-Semitism. So there was you could say is the history of the Reformed Jewish movement, which is an assimilationist movement that is trying to pass, but also be cohesive.
Yes.
So it's looking for unity and and history maybe and other things, but also was trying to pass. So, you know, for example, we had Sunday school when I was really young in the 60s, because really in the 60s there was even more of an attempt to kind of run away from the traditional ideas.
Oh, yeah. Shabbat and all.
Yeah.
Before you moved to New York in the 30 years back, did you start to already have an interest in filmmaking? Or
when I was in sixth grade, I started, I was involved in a theater in Memphis called the Memphis Children's Theater. And mm-hmm. I was an actor as a really little kid. And I was, but I was also involved, the kids ran that theater. So we kind of picked the plays and some of the plays we wrote. And then I wasn't a very good actor, and I could tell. And by 11th grade in high school, I was directing, and I directed a play, Our Town, at the Memphis Children's Theater. Mm-hmm. And so I was very interested in theater and directing. And when I went to college, I went to Yale, and I, the first semester I got there, I continued to direct plays. So I put on a lot of plays and wrote plays and created work. And then I got interested in film. I always liked movies, but I really got interested. I went to France in 86 for a few months, and I didn't speak French, and I didn't have any friends, and I ended up going to the movies
a lot,
pretty much two or three times a day.
And there's a lot of cinema in France.
So I saw
Paris especially, I guess.
I saw 197 movies in 3 months, and I was like, oh, this is what I want to do.
That's a lot of francs.
It was a lot, but they were inexpensive. You know, you could see a bunch of things. So I discovered things that I'd never heard of, like John Cassavetes, never heard of him before I got to Paris in 86, and Piélat and Truffaut and a bunch of wonderful artists for me. And I then got interested. I wanted to move out of theater, which I felt was very, for me, theater was very intellectual. It was very of the mind instead of the heart, and also less narrative, ultimately. Mm-hmm. I was influenced by more experimental theater, but I didn't really want to, it wasn't my life passion. Mm-hmm. So that's when I decided I wanted to go into film, and I applied to film school, and I didn't get in. So I just came to New York and started making movies.
How far after Yale did you move to New York?
Immediately.
Immediately after. So you got your degree and then...
Yep, then I moved to Smith Street.
Right to Smith Street.
Yep.
From New Haven to Smith Street.
Exactly.
Like
with a U-Haul and a bunch of friends who were living in the building that I was living in. And have very much maintained this community of my family here is really many people I moved from New Haven with I still see all the time. Constantly.
Oh, that's great, though, right?
Yeah.
And to have that longevity, I know it's important.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I realized at some point the friends you make in college are the last friends who know your childhood. Mm-hmm. After college, people hear story or two or three, and then they hear no stories. Mm-hmm. And they generally never met your parents, or maybe once. They've often never been to your home, and they don't really believe that there was a time before they knew you. And that's not true in college. Mm-hmm. In college, you actually come with your childhood, and your childhood is deeply part of who you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you are also in a position to reinvent yourself to some degree, because you get to a new town, new people that almost entirely probably don't know who you are.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, for me, that was partially, like, I made a decision when I went to college to arrive there as a gay, openly gay man.
Okay.
And that was...
Were you not?
I came out my senior year in high school.
Okay.
To family and to friends, but it wasn't like I lived with that identity in the way that I wanted to. I wanted to, and when I was a freshman in college, mm-hmm. which was 83, so there weren't that many openly gay people. By the end of the year, there were tons, but
right,
Yale was particularly gay at that time, to be specific about it. There was a very
big,
active and
big gay Yale.
There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that said 1 in 4, maybe more, which was our motto.
That's very funny. It's funny because I went to a really small college. I was there at the same time. I didn't graduate there, but I at the same time as Mark, your brother-in-law.
Oh,
at Bard. Yeah. So the little connections still kind of continue. And there is similar, sounds similar, where, by the end of that freshman year, it seemed like there were a lot more gay people there than
than at the beginning.
And I'm sure there were it was a better ratio, bigger ratio, or you know, a larger ratio. That's not the right way to put it, but the ratio was more gay to not gay people than even in Yale, I'm sure.
I think it attracted. Yeah, I mean, I think there are histories. At Yale, I always think the history, which was connected to the academic history, this was a point of deconstruction and literary theory and very kind of progressive identity politics were certainly a big part of the academia there. And I think it all connects to the Vietnam War, where Yale was a center of progressive thought. And so these traditions are actually rooted in choices made by the people, you know, and by the the history of the communities.
And then, you know, this time now that it's kind of like looked at as a very PC time was that was also on the cusp of that. So there was a very, very protective side to.
Yeah, I have a great. I have umbrage. That's my telephone.
Okay.
That's okay. Yeah. I mean, I can close the door. I'm going to close the door.
Yeah, just let it ring. Okay. It's okay.
I think the whole concept of political correctness as something that is like doesn't take into account the positive things that are about people's awareness of the issues that people face in a in our society, which need to be attended to. Like I feel that, you know, I'm worried by the backlash. Let's put it that way.
The backlash against PC?
Or even PC.
Yeah.
Is like it's to me, the term is such a, it's so marginalizing and it's so patronizing, a term, for actually like a battle that was fought by people to be respected and to be treated well and to get their equality. And you know, so it's a sore spot, and particularly the way it's been constructed and used at this point to sort of support a closing down of difference and the challenge of being recognized as different.
That's right. I see what you mean. You moved here, but when did you come up with, I think your first, you made a short, right? And then
I made two short films. The first one was 55 minutes long. So my first short film
arguable.
Was an hour. So it's arguable, actually. Yeah, but it was not short. It was just, you know, I didn't get into film school, and I just had watched tons of movies, and I thought I had the advantage of coming to New York at a time where filmmakers were part of a community of artists, so visual artists. So I made a work, you know, and I figured out, I wrote a script, and I had no training. I took two film classes. One was from Abigail Child, experimental film class at the Collective for Living Cinema, and the other was from Sue Friedrich, an optical printing class at Millennium. And those were my only two classes. So I wrote a film that was loosely based on an experience of having been involved in the theater, and it was called Vaudeville, and I had done a vaudeville show and traveled with the vaudeville show, and so I wrote a film kind of inspired by those experiences, and just made it. So
did it get seen?
It did get seen. It was the. I'm very grateful to a guy named Bill Gosden who ran the New Zealand Film Festival and still does. And he was the one, he was like a person who saw it out of nowhere and brought it and brought me to New Zealand to screen it.
Really?
You can find it online. It's a film with promise, without a huge amount of skill, but it doesn't look that different than my recent films in some ways. Like the aesthetics, the interest, the way it is a model for the things that have remained interesting to me since then, in terms of story and a way of shooting and a way of thinking about groups of people and private and public. And a lot of the things that it raises are continue to be relevant to me. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, was Delta?
I made one more short called Lady about a year later, and then I wrote a feature.
Was that one short?
Actually short, 28 minutes.
Okay, that's still a little bit...
shortish. And then I wrote a feature about a teenager growing up in Memphis, a closeted gay boy. But I kind of started writing it in New York and then realized that I wanted to make a more contemporary film. Like, I was writing about my past, but I wanted to make it about the present. So I moved to Memphis and spent 6 months there meeting people and rewriting the film based on kids and teenagers. And then I wrote for a Vietnamese character, and I got familiar mm-hmm. with the Vietnamese community there. And I continued to write based on the things that I discovered and the people that I was casting. So it's a neo-realist drama.
It sounds it does sound a little experimental in the approach to it, like the way you kind of evolved it based on almost like workshopping on some level.
Yes, I wouldn't say it's experimental in a class. If you're thinking about experimental film,
talk about
film,
your sisters.
Yeah, I think it there was a strategy, but I was, I'm trying to think. I mean, I feel like I was watching a lot of French cinema mm-hmm. of that time, which was, Assayas and Claire Denis and Desplechin and all these various people were making films about kids and often using non-actors. And so I was interested. Soon after, I discovered Ken Loach, and his use of non-actors was certainly mm-hmm. important to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mike Lee ever play a role in...
You know, I loved Mike Lee.
All the early stuff, especially.
I really loved his work. So there was a kind of naturalism, sort of faux naturalism to that was certainly influential. His work is much more theatrical.
Sure. Well, they rehearse. Develop the story and the characters over a long period of time.
And there's a kind of performance style, which is heightened. So.
Yeah. So the answer is yes, then? It's like an early...
I knew his films.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Because I just recall stumbling, I think it was either at the Quad or... I just vaguely remember coming across either... Yeah, the Quad or maybe what was then the Waverly... I don't remember exactly, but... And seeing a poster for Life is Sweet.
Life is Sweet, yeah.
And just sort of thinking, oh, I'm going to go walk in and see that, and just being transformed. Like,
yeah,
just thinking, that's like the greatest film ever, like... Who made this film?
Yeah.
And then just going back and finding his earlier films, and then just from then on just being a devotee of his,
Yeah, well...
Ken Loach was also a great find, but, doing something very different.
I think for me, Ken Loach, having been a real Cassavetes nut...
Yeah.
I worked for Eric Bogosian, who was a playwright and a...
Sure.
Director, and I was talk his radio assistant and for other. A little bit, and... After he saw my first film, he said, you need to stop watching Cassavetes. And it was very good advice. Like, I just needed to... And I think I couldn't really until I saw Ken Loach. And Ken Loach, in a way, was similar but different in a very interesting way to me. And there was a Ken Loach festival at the Film Society of Lincoln Center. And I saw most of his work there. And
it was like being at France all over again. You just were seeing...
Yeah, well, it was New York, and, I'm finding now, because I have kids and we're sort of rediscovering the repertory theaters here as with children, from the children's perspective, so finding movies to take my kids to, that, like, it's a way of being, like, figuring out what's playing every week and pointing what time something's going to play at 2 o'clock on a Friday. And,
yeah, sure.
And that I'm returning to, and it's really fun.
Oh, good. Yeah, and there's, by the way, finally, we went through such a drought, depressing drought of 20 years without repertory cinema. Well, very little. You had film form. You had a couple of others, but very little.
Yeah.
After you, I mean, I grew up in New York when there was just a dozen.
I came here, too.
It was still going on.
It's still going on.
Yeah.
The Van Damme, the Bleecker Street, the,
all just lots of Metro or whatever. Yeah. There was just tons of options,
Yeah,
and
the St. Mark's, the one on St. Mark's, the two. Which House.
Yeah, the St. Mark's Cinema.
Yep.
Right, and the what do you call it? Uptown,
the Thalia.
Thalia, thank you. Yeah, it's I miss it, but it's good to see it a resurgence going on here.
It is. It's
isn't it?
It's wonderful, and it's vibrant, and you sort of feel like there's not enough time to actually see all the things.
It's true.
But in a great way. It's like any night you could actually just look in the paper and you could find some great movie to
some
see.
Some great print, restored print, beautiful.
I mean, unfortunately, it's not going to recreate the period in which all those films are made. Like, there's still a lack of capital to make and to sustain. I mean, from my perspective, one of the biggest problems is not just there's not money to make a film, there's very little possibility for people to sustain and thus get better. as filmmakers in a rigorous,
right,
artistic way.
Well, all the studio money goes towards enormous products, you know, that are, or, you know, which are tied to, you know, an enormous amount of other products, and so that's where the money's at, you know. And it would be nice if that just caved in on itself, and then they would say, well, let's go back to making movies about characters again, yeah, and stories, and you know, that's like the ultimate dream. But I'm probably, to be realistic, that's not happening anytime soon.
Yeah, it's, you know, times change.
You know, yeah.
I try to avoid nostalgia, even though I might
Me too.
Have it. It's, yeah, it's not a healthy. You know, there's other alternatives to nostalgia when you notice things are different than you would like them to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, that, I think, when I think about that, that's, I started a nonprofit about 5 or 6 years ago called Queer Art. And it, I would say that its mission is to be an alternative against the absence of possibility and economics for the creation of work, queer work, because as a gay filmmaker, which, uh-huh, I can semi-identify myself as a gay filmmaker, you just realize that both internally and externally, everything said, don't make those films, don't use those, don't tell those stories, because there's no sustainable, again, it's about sustainability, there's no sustainable economic model of, you know, there's no Téchiné in America.
Right. Yeah. Sadly. Yeah. Yeah.
There's no, there's no Fassbender, obviously, but, you know, there's the, and I understand how continually you're like, make that other film, you know, or make a film in which gayness is metaphorized, you know,
yeah,
instead of explicit.
So what is queer art? What is the mission? What is it?
We have a number of programs that support artists in four disciplines across generations. So, and across those disciplines. So we have programs in film, visual arts, literature, and performance. The central program is a mentorship program, which is a year long, mentorship between an established artist and an emerging artist in one field.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 10 of those pairs every year. And they also meet as a group every year. And so our focus is to support the development of craft and professional resources, to get money into the hands of queer artists, and also to provide opportunities for public performance and public presentation. So we think of ourselves as a little institute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've learned a lot from being involved with the Sundance Institute for a long time, and seeing how these kind of apparatus can create possibility and industry over,
mm-hmm,
time,
mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm,
thinking about that model.
So how long has it existed, Queer Art?
The programs have existed for about 8 years. We became a full-time nonprofit.
Like you said, 6 years ago, I think 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, probably 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. This year, actually, on November 2nd, we have our first Queer Art Prize, which HBO is sponsoring. We're giving away two $10,000 prizes to,
wow,
queer artists. And, you know, we're beginning to build kind of an infrastructure which allows us to, like, create community and to give some money and do those things simultaneously.
Where do you operate out of? Or
we
from?
Operate out of my office at this point with a staff of three, uh-huh, and kind of two and a halfs. And, you know, we're really grassroots organization.
Yeah.
It's been great. It's been, I mean, really an amazing group of people are starting to kind of be connected.
Right,
to
like
the,
kind of a community. Out
a
of
community
that.
is growing.
Yeah. So, and how do people find it? How do people find you if you're indeed self-identify as a queer artist?
Yeah.
And you want to
queerart.org, uh-huh, online is our website, and you can, we run a monthly program at the IFC called Queer Art Film.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's, yeah, we're in 100 months. We've been doing that. So that's
right now, 100 months.
We're 104 now.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. We hit our,
I just
100.
Missed it. Could have tied it together.
Yeah.
Like that.
But it's great to me. There is this thing that, I guess what happened is in 2008, there was the recession, and it's very,
I heard about it.
Yeah. It was kind of big, and it, yeah, trickles down in every way. And I think it was the end of the independent film business as we began to expect it in the earlier 2000s. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to rethink of my the possibility of my own work. I ended up making, I couldn't make a film for 3 years. I had a script. I had a script with like everybody in your brother cast, you know, it was like Michael Shannon and Damian Lewis and Patricia Clarkson and Kirsten Dunst.
These are like the royalty of independent film.
And they were all interested in being in the movie, and we couldn't raise a dollar, literally. But it was 2008.
Yeah.
Like it was just. Right. And so I was either going to not be a filmmaker or discover some other way. And I started teaching at NYU in the graduate film department. And I was encouraging my students to take themselves seriously as an artist and make what was possible and not just make student films. And I sort of told that to myself, and I made a 10-minute film called Last Address.
Yes, which I saw. Yeah.
And it was very rewarding. Like, I made it at the top level that I could. I could afford it. It was $2,000.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is how I'm going to make films again. I'm just going to figure out from what are my own resources and expect nothing from the industry. And nothing from the conventional structure of independent financing. And that's been how I've made my last three films, is to reinvent myself.
So out of that, you mean, came Keep the Lights On.
Keep the Lights On, which then there were like 300 people involved in financing that film. And it was a communal effort. I had been working, organizing queer art. And so I had a community that was around me. And I went to that community and I begged and hollered and hustled and got to make that movie.
Was that a new using new muscles?
It was using, like, I mean, basically I became a producer.
Yeah. Right.
But I produced by community organizing. So I was also working on the Obama campaign in 2008 and organizing my friends, and so I learned how to organize.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Really.
So you took those principles and you applied them to filmmaking on some level.
I applied them to filmmaking and almost simultaneously, yeah, I applied them to the creation of this nonprofit. Like they were very overlapping. An interest. It was also an interest in like my own work and, Last Address was inspiring for me in lots of reasons. It was a film about a group of New York artists who died of AIDS, and I shot the houses where they lived. But I also got very familiar with the work of a lot of those artists and thought about New York in the 70s, and I thought about how a lot of those artists worked without expectation that the system was going to support them. They were
interesting.
The anti-system,
right,
or oppositional to the system.
Yeah.
And they didn't. They were less bourgeois in many ways. I mean,
it was a commitment, a level of commitment to art for art's sake that you ultimately is what.
And either you get to make
about.
It or you don't. You either survive or you don't.
Yeah. In the 70s, you could survive on a lot less in the city. So the imperative was very different. Like, it wasn't only financial, whereas now, if you want to live in New York and make art, you know, you got to do a lot of corporate gig. I don't know what you do, but it's not quite as so pure.
It's not in, but we're also in our 50s, so we don't really know what 20-year-olds. I always feel like you can't really speak to what it is to be a 20-year-old.
No,
we don't live in the same areas, and we don't know what exactly. True. But I'm sure it's different, and definitely the city is different. There was also, in the 80s, there was the AIDS crisis, so there was an extraordinary urgency politically. And a fear and a power, and I mean, there was lots of things going on, and I think that sense of of the will to make yourself heard was something that I went back to when I started making Keep the Lights On.
Well, I did. That was my introduction. I had been hearing about you for a while, but that was my introduction to you. Mm. I was probably still relatively new at doing this thing, but
there weren't that many films, so you didn't miss that much.
No, well, it's interesting though, when, by the time I sat with you the first time, the Brigade, I think, was doing your marketing for Keep the Lights On.
Yes.
And, cause I remember that they also sent me all your films.
Oh yeah.
So I saw them all.
Oh, nice.
And then I also watched the documentary, the one on the home, the houses.
Oh, Last Address.
Last Address, excuse me.
Yeah.
So I felt really, really, when I walked in, I had only heard, I heard things about you and was a little, I wouldn't say intimidated, I just wasn't, I was walking in like, I better just be a little bit prepared here.
Oh.
Like I'm not normally, but, and so, and then I think, well, you were just the nicest guy, but I think having seen like Last Address and talking about it as well, just sort of really was a great way into talking to you. And now I understand a little bit more contextually why that would be.
Yeah, it was a very, it was like, I mean, it's interesting because I'm now, I've spent the last 2 years writing for television, and it's, and I'm now back in the feature world writing a feature, and I'm just more, I'm probably more potent, and in this particular, I'm really attached to the art film. It's what my mind and my imagination is. And
what was the TV?
I wrote a film for HBO with Mauricio Zacharias, my co-writer, about Montgomery Clift, which is not going to get made. And then I'm working on a miniseries based on a book called Christadora by Tim Murphy. We're writing it with Paramount, and we'll see if the studio has to buy it. So it's a business. Christadora, the building. So it's a novel that he wrote set in the Christadora from the 1980s to the present. Uh-huh. So it's sort of, it's focused on a family, multiple generations, but it's also
like
in the time of, that I've been in New York and in the times of the worst of the AIDS epidemic and the period after. But TV and film are not the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And anyone who tells you they are is not true.
A montage of all the people on my show have talked, so compared the two things.
as similar.
No, I don't know if anybody has ever done that, but there are people, I guess, who are.
Well, I just think they're different mediums, and the biggest medium, the biggest thing that's different to me is its relationship to capitalism.
Uh-huh.
So television is a corporate entity, so there's a corporation involved, and you can't avoid and that's not independent film.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't say you're taking the independent film process into TV, because as soon as you're into TV, you're not independent. So it changes everything.
Sure.
And
that wasn't.
Yeah.
That was not a positive experience for you. Felt like when you're out of that all of a sudden you were liberated again, like into your comfort zone, which is what you're just sort of saying.
I'm still in it a little bit, but it's not my comfort zone.
It sounded like it was, difficult. But Montgomery Clift, it's not happening. Is that what you're saying?
It's not happening.
They just opted out of
that. Opted out. Yeah.
There needs to be a Montgomery Clift story to
Montgomery
be told.
Clift is still dead. That's what I would say.
Okay. Monty, we miss you. But that's like an incredible story, and I don't recall anybody making a story a film about.
No.
And it seems right for HBO. I don't know. But I'm sure. There's answers to that.
There's reasons. And many people, Lumet or was it Pakula? I think it was Pakula tried to make a...
It was a Sydney. No, wait, Pakula's Alan.
I think it was Pakula tried to make a... But it could have been Lumet. I get confused. It was probably Lumet.
It doesn't sound like a Lumet, but then again...
One of them tried to make a two-part movie.
Okay.
People have tried to make it, but it keeps defeating them.
Yeah. Todd made, I just had Todd Haynes on the show, and he made, of course, for HBO, right? He did the...
Mildred Pierce,
thank you. So, and that was a two-part, it just seems that this would be, HBO would be perfect for, but I'm stepping out of mind.
Yeah. Knowledge base,
I completely...
It's all, decisions are made, and I think for me, I'm excited to just be, I feel extremely grateful and surprised that I'm actually able to continue to make movies.
Yeah.
Like it's the opposite of a given. And in 2008, it was kind of over. And, the fact that I've emerged from the ashes
seems
to me something not to take advantage, so not to take for granted.
Sure.
So, Yeah, I'm telling that to myself right now. It's really, I'm not just telling it to you and your audience. It's just, you really got to, and I think it's about being in our 50s too. It's like, you can see the sun setting. It's not too far. And so you have to figure out what you want to do with your days.
Yeah. Do you feel that the type of size of the film you're making, that is your plan for the next one?
I would be very happy to make the size of the film. I would, you know, for the people involved, I wish there was a little bit more money.
Sure.
Because I'm always, like, for example, I never get to work with the same DP twice because I can never afford them the next time.
Oh, wow.
In general, they're like, that was great. I loved it. And I can't work for that rate because it's such a killer. So everybody isn't paid enough. So that's right. The exploitation process. Yeah. Artistically, I hope that I offer the people I work with something meaningful. But also the industry doesn't then, it's not like these movies are making a lot of money if they're making any money. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough one. Economically. If I can make movies this size, I'm thrilled. I think there's something I don't have. I don't wish for something else, which is maybe a pro. I'm not sure what that's going to feel like. If that's going to be, you still have to find the drive to do things. So I think that you have to not be complacent either. So maybe I need to go to therapy.
It can't hurt. Well, it could, I guess. It could sort of impact the creative process on some level. If
well,
you start
I did 17
over,
years, like, so you know, I,
oh,
I,
yeah.
I was. I'm
I think I
totally,
remember you were talking about.
I'm very
before.
Pro self analysis and introspection. I think maybe it's like being. I'm an old young parent, so having two kids. I'm so focused on like the kind of what the day the present, not the past, it's just, you know, there's a demand right now. What has to happen? Who has to get where? Who has to be fed? Who has to, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Do you, you know, with the, early on, you mentioned the impact of Cassavetes and a couple other, and Loach, who both have a very, what they say is a documentary style of making their films.
Yeah.
You know, with some exceptions. But,
yes.
But generally, in terms of the way it's shot and the feeling of that you're right there,
yeah.
You know, in there, and that it's very, feels very, very, very real, raw.
Right.
So I'm just, and there has definitely been a rawness in a couple of your films that I've seen for sure. But I wonder if you were ever, since you made this short documentary, ever feel compelled to make another documentary or a full?
No, because I'm not patient enough to do what you have to do to get the stories and to get the scenes. Like,
yeah,
I
could take years.
I respect that how difficult it is to capture a scene in life. I mean, I think for me, I'm also, you know, I do have very central influences that I feel, and I would say after Loach, I'm still deeply in the Piela phase of my own. Maurice Piala is a French director of the 70s and 80s, made Anos Amor and Lulu.
Oh, I guess I have seen his name recently. Yeah.
Because
of all the repertory.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary deceased man whose films were, but I'm also like, I went through a very, with my co-writer, we were deeply into Ozu and Satyajit Ray, which are more theatrical, and so I'm in a way, I think I'll go back to this coming to New York, not getting into film school, and then really just thinking, okay, you're part of a history, and you're battling with the greats, and you'll never achieve that, but you're still really, they're part of your imagination, and you're part of your conversation, and I feel deeply in that, like, so that is all around fiction. It's certainly not about documentary. It's about the history of narrative cinema.
Mm. Well, thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Are we right?
It's good.
Around,
no, we're good.
Are we right around the?
Yeah. I hope you got something there.
I think so. A little, I like to do a little light editing. Just
yeah, sure.
So I don't sound stupid. As much
no,
as
not at all. Enough.
But that was great. Thank you very much for everything. Yeah, yeah, that's a good idea. Hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. I love that. That was great. We'll bring Ira back on again when he has a new project for 20 minutes. You know. Okay, here we go. These are the backers. I don't remember where I left off last time, so I'm just going to read through everybody's names. Bear with me. But I do want to thank you all. And if you wanted to be private, I really apologize. It's not the end of the world, though. I don't think that... There are some people who you can't identify, and with those, I did reach out to them through, you know, generically, I didn't have their name, so I just said, who are you, backer, blah, blah, blah. And in many cases, they got back to me, but some they didn't. But if they do, in the meantime, since, you know, in the future, I will be thanking them. So I want to go over again, thanking Peter Rinaldi, Theodore Belucas, Adam King, K-A-H-A-N, Taylor Moore, Kevin Schreck, Lori Lusthouse, Adam Siegel, Frank Mosley, Lauren Modry, Judith Mizraki, Susie Greenwood, someone named James, Patrick Bryce, Christopher Jason Bell, Adam Pogoff, Carl Kranz, Lynn Sachs, and Lizzie Olesker, Matt Hopkins, Ariel Cavusi, Doug Block, George Manitos, Jason Cortland, and Julie Halperin, Joel Fendelman, Charles Bakel, Rebby Ratner, Alan Lefebvre, Herbert Gamble, Ari Gold, Ethan Gold, Sajiwa Ekanayaka, Michelle Negroponte, Marshall Curry, Zach Norman, Neil Cohen, James Hancock, Jamie Block, Alan Berliner, Adam Reed, Michael Galinsky and Suki Hawley, Walter Monty, Scott McCauley, Tessa Muji, Stephen Stewart, Justin Shine, Jeffrey Roland Leiser, James Oxford, Patrick Wang, Alex Malice, Caitlin May Burke, Stacy Colonna, Michael Rosado Bennett, Art Jones, Naomi Schlegoff, Keith Kamen, Joshua Weinstein, Alan Ferguson, Garrett Savage, Rachel Schumann, Benjamin Dickinson, Alexander Rockwell, Kevin Briscoe, Kristen McCracken, Lauren Wolkstein, Brent Barber, Yancey Ford, Alex Lehman, Corinne Colgan, Lucio Zago, Tyler Meesum, Tony Hale, Chris Scotchdopo, who I think is Larry Fessenden. Sorry, Larry, I'm outing you. Amy Nicholson, Barrett Mater, Rafi Rivero, Cindy and Harvey Silver, Jeffrey Hoffman, Inni Prakash, Sheila Nevins, Tiffany Bartok, and Jace Bartok, Dan Schoenbrunn, Laura Heberton, Eddie Vellante, Dominic Davis, Paul Brill, Keith Miller, Matthew Seitz, Maria Soker, Kent Moran, Yan Tan, Avi Zev Weider and Alexandra Berger, Lizzie Borden, Maxim Pozdrovkin, Bodine Bowling, Trish Dalton, Holly Kulka, Megan Griffiths, Bryce, not sure who Bryce is. I know a couple of Bryces. Aaron West, Danny Sun, Jason Clorfine, Glenn Rauscher and Andrew Shane, Jonathan Leaf, Ronnie McIntosh, Harrison Bender, The Film Panel Note Taker, Josh Crockett and Kristen Slazeman, Kazimir Noskowski, Bob Berger and Patrick Daniels, Richard Heumann, Jen Sanko, Melanie Addington, Ann Andrew, Amy Breakstone, Laura Poitras, Theodore Kalatos, Mary Spitzer and Phil Spitzer, Kirsten Johnson, Kenneth Ang, Glenn Kenny, Frank Hall Green, Gina Miller, Jonathan Kiefer, Jessica Wolfson and Paul Lovelace, Katha Cato and Don Cato, Holly Hardman, Elizabeth Sperling, Amy Engel, Janet Singer, Philip Shane, Zephyr Thrall, Denari Braxton, Lana Wilson, and Betty Kaplan. Thank you all so much so far. I hope to announce double that next time. But I think I can remember where I left off. But I wanted to thank you all from my heart. Also, I know many, many of you are maybe not being able to necessarily, or can't for one reason or another, necessarily kick in money, which is fine. They're sharing. Some people who are kicking in are also sharing, so thank you for that. Whatever you can do, if you even get me one person who didn't know beforehand that this podcast exists and that I'm trying to do something important, something special for the independent film community, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. So I will be back in a couple of days. In the meantime, my name is Adam Shartoff. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio. Take care of yourself and the ones you love. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs.